They grow warm, thick hair. They change their diets. Some of them even move to new homes. Today, we'll talk about how wild animals survive the winter. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We haven't had much of a winter so far this year, but wild animals still need to make accommodations. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease will be here today to give us some insight into how wild creatures cope when the temperatures drop and the snow gets deep. We'll also talk about how an unseasonably warm winter with no snow at all might affect them. Are migratory journeys being cut short? Will mating season come early this year? We'll find out. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's just another warm, sunny January day in Iowa, and wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with us to talk about winter. Hi, Jim.
I walked across campus without gloves on. It's amazing for the 9th of January.
It is remarkable.
Yeah, spent all day outdoors yesterday. Working out at the Iowa Wildlife Center that we talked about last month on this program, and we've got some construction done that we didn't expect to get done until spring. So
I'm sure a lot of people have had moments like that. And Friday, on Horticulture Day, somebody called and asked if they could plant garlic, which is something you normally can't do in January either. So although this hasn't been a challenging winter for wildlife so far, nobody knew that going into it, not even the all-seeing groundhog, probably. So winter preparations were made. And when did those winter preparations get underway for most creatures?
For most critters, it starts late summer. In some bird species are already migrating south by mid-August, believe it or not. And others are beginning to fatten up. Some of the mammals are beginning to fatten up in early September in preparation for hibernation, or just kind of getting ready for the winter, to taking advantage of the largesse of food that's available to fatten up and create those fat reserves that are necessary for them.
Well, let's start with those hibernators, because, of course, there are a number of creatures that pretty much sleep through the winter months. Then they do store up fat so they can survive those cold, snowy months
Sure.
that we're not having this year. But what gives them a cue? What tells them now is the time to go to sleep?
It's interesting, because you would think that it would be temperatures, because there is a variation from north to south in when hibernators will go into hibernation in terms of the date when they go into hibernation. But it really is the day length, the photo period, that triggers that much more than weather. That's why we're not seeing, in most locations in the state, 13-line ground squirrels or woodchucks, also known as groundhogs or whistlepigs, they're not coming out from hibernation. The ground isn't frozen so much, but it's certainly cold, and they take their triggers in part from the temperature of the soil around them, but especially the day length. And the day length still says this is the 9th of January, and they're not coming out.
So there is no phenomena right now where we see hibernators waking up.
No,
and coming out.
Not. I haven't heard of any reports. There may be some. Maybe some of our listeners will call in and say, "Well, I happened to see a groundhog yesterday, or I saw a ground squirrel." Now, we need to distinguish, though, between 13-line ground squirrels and chipmunks. Chipmunks will come out on days like we've had, because they are not hibernators. They are sleepers, but their body temperatures don't drop all that much, and they wake up and go and feed all through the winter. If they can't get out and feed, which they could the last couple of weeks, actually, but they rely on the pantries of food that they've got stored underground or in a tree, and can feed off that that stored food so that they don't have to live off their fat reserves as the true hibernators do.
Is there a term for that for creatures like the ground squirrels who would get up and go back to sleep?
Not ground squirrels. Ground squirrels are the true hibernators. Yeah, the chipmunks.
Chipmunks is what I meant to say.
Yeah, no, they can be active all winter. Same as skunks, same as possums, but they're not true hibernators, but they do sleep for long periods. I don't know of a term that applies to them. There may be one that I'm not familiar with, but sleepers, we'll call them.
So when you talk about chipmunks having food stored in their burrows so they can get to that, what about some of the other creatures like skunks and possums? How do they get ready for surviving the winter? Because, of course, the kinds of food that they normally eat when the snow covers the ground is a lot harder to find.
Right. Raccoons, skunks, possums, all of those are sleepers that will put on considerable fat in the fall. And they do live off those fat reserves to some extent. But they have to get up and eat. And all three of those, you'll notice, are omnivores. That is, they'll eat just about anything. They have both meat supplies and vegetarian diets. And so they have, like most humans, they have a mixed diet. And because they're so adaptable, they're able to make that work for them. Because you will see, occasionally, if we ever get some snow, you'll see some skunk tracks where a skunk is wandering around during the night. Or you might smell them or see them dead on the road. And they're out collecting what they can, be it spilled corn on the side of the road or scavenging on a roadkill, grabbing some mice in underneath the snow or the grass in a field, eating some berries that are left behind, still attached to the shrubs that might be there, scarfing up a store of that a raccoon that some other critter left behind, hoping to have it for them. So they're very omnivorous, very eclectic in their dietary taste. So they can eat just about anything and make a meal out of it.
Do those kinds of creatures, do they change their diet a lot for the winter months, or are they still scavenging the same kinds of things?
Well, they'll certainly change their diet to what's available to them, depending on where they live. Those of them in Iowa, along in farm country, can often use spilled corn or corn that is left on top of the ground, or beans, or something like that, as well as a number of wild foods as well. So, yeah, they will change to very eclectic in their diets and can change to wherever they are and to make it applicable to the time of year.
When we see, for example, white-tailed deer out during the winter, you can tell the difference between their summer coat and their winter coat. They have that really thick grayish brown hair in the winter months. With animals like, let's say, skunks and raccoons, it's not as easy to see. Do their coats change a lot?
Yeah, they do. They certainly grow much more under fur in the wintertime. And in all cases, be it birds or mammals, it's all about something that on radio is a really bad thing, and that's dead air space. You don't like to hear that dead air space on radio. But if you're a critter trying to keep warm, that's what it's all about.
So they're layering just like we are.
Right, exactly. And whether you think about the coat that you put on in the morning, be it filled with down or fiber fill or what a hollow fill or whatever, it's the air spaces that are in there that are actually keeping you warm. The same is true with a mammal. They have, you'll see them sometimes shaking, and that what that shaking does is it loosens up the fur and creates more places where airspace can get in there. So they're holding in that valuable heat that their body is producing, changing food energy, chemical energy into heat energy. Those of us who are warm-blooded critters all do that. And you want to keep as much of that close to your body as you can for as long as you can, and thus the dead air spaces around them. Birds, on the other hand, use a different technique. They, of course, underneath those feathers that we see on the outside that provide the color or the differentiation, the flight feathers, that sort of thing, tail feathers, they have down underneath. And again, that what down is all about is creating dead airspace. They also have these things called pin feathers. If you've ever bought a fresh chicken that has not been prepared by a large company, you'll often have those pin feathers that are still in there. They're hair-like appendages, rather stiff. And what that does is those pin feathers help hold up the more flexible down feathers to create those dead air spaces close to the body of the bird.
We've talked about birds migrating, and we'll talk more about that in a little while. Are there mammals who live in Iowa that migrate?
there are not mammals who migrate great distances, as we think of when we think of caribou in the Arctic or in Alaska. We don't have mammals that do that anymore. Perhaps bison and elk, because we see some migration of bison and elk in places out west, Yellowstone and that. Most of that is vertical migration from high altitudes to lower altitudes. But sometimes it is migration to other areas, the same altitude even, that provide more food for them. So there is some migratory effort on their part. We also see in the fall of the year what I've sometimes called the fall shuffle, a new dance that we could do. But critters have been doing it for a long, long time, and you'll see things like raccoons and skunks, 35 to 40% of a population in the fall will strike out on its own to try and find new territory. Usually those are young animals, but they're not migrating in the sense that we think of it to find better food supplies to survive the winter. It's more a territorial migration. So we don't have the kinds of migrations in most mammals that we see in birds at all. We do get some muskrats when they get overpopulated in a marsh, will migrate out of those marshes across. It's amazing that it will move across land. You would never expect to see them on cross prairies to find another marsh to populate. But again, that's a population crowding thing, not necessarily a response to the changing of the weather.
Well, we also see, for example, deer yarding up, deer coming together. They may be in different places and
sure,
of course, as a group. We don't have much time before the break, but what benefit does it give them to be in such a large group?
Well, it helps them in terms of protection from predators. The more eyes you've got open, at least some of the time, the better chance you have of survival. The disadvantage, and it's a trade-off, the disadvantage is that you're eating from the same food supply. You're all eating from the same food supply in the same area. So there are always these trade-offs to get through the winter months.
We'll talk more in just a moment. My guest is wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're talking today about how wild animals survive the winter. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe here today with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're talking about how wild animals adapt and survive the harsh Iowa winters, although this year not a particularly harsh winter. And of course, if you have questions, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And if you have some observations from this unusual winter, some strange things you've seen, we'd love to hear your stories as well. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, we've talked a lot about mammals, so let's talk a little bit about birds. And as you mentioned earlier, with migratory birds, some of them start their migrations in August, but there are birds that migrate that don't seem to have gone anywhere this year.
What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about Canada geese.
Canada geese, yeah. Yeah, in fact, I was watching as I came in this morning. I watched, there were probably on a lake here in Ames, 1,100 or 1,200 geese still on the lake. And the lake has done something that has been quite unusual, at least unusual in the sense of the last half a dozen winters. And I've seen this in lakes across the state, perhaps not in the most northern portion of the state, but especially in the southern two-thirds of the state. Because of the warm days we've had and alternating sort of between a week of warm and sort of a week of cold, the lakes have frozen sort of, but then unfrozen. Any of our ice anglers out there can attest to this. The ice is not very thick and certainly not safe yet.
Yeah, I'm sure there are people planning to build ice houses on pontoons at this
point. Yeah, exactly. It'd be a good safe way to do it. And what's happened is the birds have had lots of open water. And the geese will hang around as long as there's a little bit of open water. And even after it gets frozen, it seems like they're, well, if we hang around long enough, this will open back up again. And so far, they've been right. So the geese have been hanging around. They're pretty tough birds. You'll notice a lot of them standing around sort of on one leg. And this is really on top of the ice where it is frozen. And it's quite an interesting adaptation. A lot of geese and ducks can actually deliberately reduce the flow of blood to those extremities, to their feet and legs, which are not covered by feathers, incidentally. So you would say, well, gee, there's going to be a lot of heat loss out of that foot or that leg, especially if it's standing on ice. So what you do is you reduce in some cases, as much as 90% of the blood flow is cut off from those extremities, and they can therefore reduce the heat loss as well. There's still enough oxygen that goes there to keep the limb alive, to keep the foot alive, but not so much that it's going to be a tremendous source of heat loss. And then they stand on one leg, tuck the other one up underneath there, so you're only losing a little bit of heat to that one foot that's on the ice. It's kind of an interesting adaptation.
Yeah, it sounds very difficult. Clearly, they're much better at it than we would be.
Standing on one leg.
Right, exactly. I don't think that would be a good tactic for me.
Or barefoot on the ice, right. Either, for that matter.
Well, you mentioned the Canada geese in Ames. In the Cedar Falls area, south of town, mm-hmm. there is a place where there are thousands and thousands and thousands of geese. And one of the interesting things that I've noticed this year as I drive up to my folks' house is that I'll be driving in the evenings, and about sunset, just flocks and flocks and flocks of these geese will take wing.
Right.
Where are they going?
Well, it may be that they're just jockeying for position, but they're going to a place wherever it is they want to spend the night. And that may vary a little bit depending on what kinds of harassment they're getting from the local coyote population or the owls around the area, other predators. But it also may depend on their whims, what they decide is the best place to spend the night. In most cases, in the morning when they're going out from those areas, they're going out to feed on fields up to 10 or 12 miles out from the from their roost area. They may go quite a distance to find food and then come back to the same area each night.
Well, it sure makes sunset a beautiful and exciting time.
It sure does.
It's a and we have time lots to of take a walk.
Yeah, we have lots of geese around right now. Not only because we've had a mild winter and lots of open water still, but also we've had certainly people are aware that there are an awful lot of geese that are taking advantage of urban areas now. And because geese are grazers, I think I saw along Interstate 35 between Des Moines and Ames on Saturday evening, probably saw 3,000 geese along one of the businesses have these nice ponds out in front. And
Often aerated.
Yes, exactly. Aerated often. And there are 3,000 geese around it. They mow around it, so it creates a perfect area for them. The same thing we do with golf courses and that. We mow them. We fertilize that grass. We water it. And then we put a pond in the middle of it, and we wonder why geese like it. Well, we've created perfect goose habitat, and there are few predators there, so they think, boy, thank you very much. This is goose heaven, you know. So we've created areas for them that are perfect for the kinds of things that geese like, and so geese populations, goose populations in and around urban areas or even small towns have really skyrocketed.
Well, on the subject of water, one of our listeners sent this question. How do wild animals find water sources during the winter, especially this year when lakes and streams are frozen over, but there isn't any snow?
Actually, there are an awful lot of places where the lakes and streams are not frozen over, and so it is easy to find, much easier this year than in the past. One of the things they do is that they get a lot of the moisture they need from the food that they eat. They're able to extract it from that food much more efficiently in the wintertime even than in the summer. And so that's one way. But they really are able to find tremendous numbers of places from little trickles that might come out of a tile drain of a field, streams that are protected down in a valley from wind that will remove the heat more quickly. And
I suppose if the sun is shining, even just a tiny pool could form on top of the ice.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. In fact, I noticed the Ada Hayden Lake this morning had a new pool of water on top. And, it's not very difficult for them at all. Now, sometimes in extreme winters, that can be a bit of a challenge. And, in fact, a lot of people who feed birds in the winter take advantage of that by providing water that is unfrozen in the form of bird baths that are heated through the winter months, and they find that there are critters, there are birds that will come to those that won't come for the feed. Robins, cedar waxwings will come to those bird baths specifically for the water and not bother with the feed at all.
We have a number of callers on the line who have seen some unusual things this winter, and Randy is up first at 866-780-9100 from Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Hi there. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said the public radio was commenting about the huge amount of snowy owls that were hatched up in the Arctic, and they said the guy was saying on the radio they've seen them as far south as Oklahoma. So here, would you see them about dark? If they're around.
Well, and I know a number of people who have seen them in the Iowa City area recently. There have been, and near the Cedar Rapids Airport, there have been a lot of snowy owl sightings recently.
Yeah, there have been some really, a lot of snowy owl sightings across the state, and a number of naturalists with county conservation boards and with the DNR have people had brought into them dead snowy owls or told them about them along the, where they've been hit along the road or they've hit a power line. So we've gotten a lot of reports, and certainly this is an invasion year. Usually the invasion years of snowy owls come once every 3 to 5 years. We'll have what we call an invasion year. This is an Arctic species. They're used to nesting on the ground, and because trees are only 3 or 4 or 5, 6 inches high in the Arctic, they're not used to tall trees at all. So usually when you spy them, you can drive along the road and you can see them in fence rows on the ground or very near the ground. At most they might be up on a fence post. They very seldom get up high in the trees. And they do this because of populations of their primary food supplies, small mammals, especially lemmings and several other species of voles and that in the Arctic, go through population cycles where one year they might be at a peak in the cycle where there are lots and lots of them around. And a year or two later, they bottom out, and there are hardly any around. And it's in those years, in those troughs in the cycle of voles and lemmings, where the snowy owls will come south seeking food. sometimes they don't get as far as Iowa. You'll see them in some of the northern states. Sometimes they go a lot farther south. We're not at all certain why this year in particular we're seeing so many of them and much farther south than usual. I haven't been able to find out from friends if the rumor that it's not a low in the small mammals populations in the Arctic, so nobody knows why they're coming, or if it was just a very successful year for the owls and some of them, more of them came south than usual, despite the non-trough in the lemming population. So I haven't been able to confirm that yet, but so we don't really know why they're here. It certainly has something to do with food, and they're kind of spreading out trying to find that. So it appears that they did have a very successful breeding season because there are so many of them around and many more than we would expect.
But this is naturally part of their territory. They're not
right.
In a really unusual place. We're just seeing more of them.
Right. We're seeing more of them. And certainly, as I say, I think Randy was asking about how to find them. Yeah, you can go out any time of the day or evening. Doesn't have to be at night. Remember where they come from in the Arctic. They have 24 hours of daylight in the summertime, and in the winter, depths of winter right now, they're having 24 hours of darkness. So they depend on their sense of hearing in the winter and their sense of sight in the summer. So they can hunt daytime or nighttime. And so you can see them at any time of the day, but look close to the ground, probably no higher usually than the top of a fence post, because they're not accustomed to trees. They tend to spend more time on the ground than other owls that we would have.
Oh, that's fascinating. And they're not strictly nocturnal then, even when they get down here?
Not at all. No, they're pretty adaptable, yeah.
Ellen's on the line from Fairfield. Hi, Ellen.
Yes, hello. A cougar was sighted right up my driveway. I live in Fairfield, Iowa. I live out in the country, and they said he was huge, and he was unmistakably a cougar, and that he took one leap into the middle of the street and then one leap off. So he was took quite a jump. And I have been hearing about them just a little bit, but this was right up my driveway, mm-hmm. And I'm curious why they're here. And I have beautiful places to walk around my house, and I'm a little nervous to take a walk now. Mm-hmm. And I was curious what you would say about this.
Sure, there are always lots of reports of cougars, particularly within the first few weeks after a story comes out about a confirmed sighting of them or in an area. And there was a confirmed, there was actually one shot, I think, out in Monona County in western Iowa just a couple of weeks ago, and that was in all the papers and everything. So I know that, in fact, I think it was on reported on a public radio broadcast as well over Iowa Public Radio. But anyway, so we always expect to hear and see lots of other sightings and reports of sightings of that in the few weeks after that. Now, that may sound like a cynical response, and so I don't mean it to be, but it is true that many more people see them after they've see in quotes after they've been there's been a report about them in the news media. Now, that's not to say it's not. Cougars are, or also known as mountain lions, also known as pumas. They are all native to Iowa. They were native to Iowa. They were wiped out by our Euro-American ancestors by the 1880s or so in Iowa. The cougars that are sighted here, we don't have a population of them. The ones that we have are usually young males that get cast out from their mother, by their mother, say, you go find your own territory. And the males tend to wander more widely than the females do. And so these are males coming from surrounding states, and they'll wander into Iowa in search of food. And when we have high deer populations, particularly when we had very high deer populations a few years ago. They were sighted more regularly here than in other years. In terms of being afraid to go out, I wouldn't be. Certainly go and walk. You're an adult person in your neighborhood. I think that would be fine. The other thing I would do would be to consider whoever told you. Did you see this?
No, she's no longer on the line.
She's no longer on the line.
She said it was her neighbor.
Yeah, her neighbor. You have to think about, well, was this really unmistakably a cougar, or was this? Many of the reports have been shown to be people. There was one last year on this program, as a matter of fact, when I looked at the. I think, Charity, you posted it on the or sent
right,
it
there
to
was,
me.
There was a video.
Yeah, and it was a cat. It was a large tomcat, perhaps, but it was very clearly a cat. And because of the panic in the woman's voice that was recording this, she immediately blew up the size of the critter very, very quickly. So it was.
There have been. You know, yeah. And I've seen night vision cameras on various trails. I think I've seen two pictures of cougars from night vision cameras in Iowa this year. So there have been genuine sightings.
Yeah, and we would expect them to continue because, as I say, many of these critters are expanding their range or trying to expand their range, and they come into Iowa as sort of open country where they might find enough food to survive. Most of the cougars, in fact, I'm aware of two that were actually killed on the roads several years ago. And when we inspected them, they were necropsy. They lacked front claws, meaning that they had been somebody's
escaped pets.
So-called pet, right. and they either let them go or they did escape as well. So, yeah.
We're talking about how wild animals survive the winter in Iowa, whether it's warm or whether it's cold. Jim Pease is here with me today, wildlife biologist and consultant in the Ames area. And, of course, we'll take your calls when we get back. The number to call is 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talks and email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me today. We're talking about how wild creatures survive the winter in Iowa, some of the adaptations that they have that make it possible for them to survive harsh conditions, although we haven't seen harsh conditions this year. They do occur.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. One of the things I wanted to mention about birds that some people don't realize is that a lot of birds, we think about the mammals. We talked about the 13-legged ground squirrels and the woodchucks that go into hibernation. Bats do as well. But birds do something that is quite fascinating, and as we learn about it, we're finding that more and more birds do. They actually reduce their body temperature at night so that they're maybe as much as 20, 30 degrees. It's a sort of a temporary state of hibernation. It's called torpor, T-O-R-P-O-R. And some small mammals, some of the little mice critters, do the same. And just on a daily basis, they'll reduce that temperature overnight. Things like we knew about it in hummingbirds, it was most common, and some of the nightjars, things like whippoorwills and that. We knew about it in those. But increasingly, we're finding more and more birds and some small mammals that do the same thing. If we do that, we call that hypothermia, and we can die from that, you know. But some other critters are able to go into sort of a temporary hibernation, I think you call it, but their body core doesn't go down as low as true hibernators do. So it's pretty fascinating things.
And how long would a state of torpor last for a bird?
Usually just overnight. They'll wake up in the morning, and then the sun comes up, and they come back up to temperature within just a few minutes and fly away. It's pretty remarkable.
What's the advantage of doing that?
Well, when you think about it, you're right. There's a trade-off. The trade-off is that you are, you know, perhaps making yourself less wary. You're less certainly aware of the environment around you, the potential predation, that sort of thing. But you're reducing the need to produce as much heat. One of the things that birds do, especially at night, is they shiver. Shivering is a natural response to cold, and it creates heat energy from food energy or chemical energy in your body. And it's a normal response in birds and mammals. And birds do it a lot in cold winters, especially, to produce heat through the night. So they'll sit there and they'll shiver underneath there. Those muscles are creating heat by doing that. It's not a matter of, their poor little things are cold. That it's a natural body response to produce the heat that's necessary. And so if your body temperature is lower, you have to produce less heat. So the food supplies that are necessary to get through the night are much less than they would be if you had to maintain 101 degree temperature, which is what most birds are.
So it's all about energy conservation.
You bet.
Vern is on the line somewhere north of Ryan. Hi, Vern. Oh,
wow.
Hello.
Can you hear us? Yes. What's your story?
If Mr. Pease had ever in the wild spotted a black and white zebra-striped turkey?
Well, the wings are sort of black and white. The wing feathers are black and white striped. But I've never seen one. No, zebra-striped turkey, that would be very unusual. Probably a crossbreed with something else. There's certainly lots of colors. Color variation is one of the relatively easy things that is constantly going on in nature. It's a way of those genes generally don't survive very long in a population. But, that would be an interesting one.
Yeah, with Vern's phone, I'm not going to put him back on, but he said that he saw two black and white zebra-striped turkeys in a herd of wild turkeys. That must have been quite a sight.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we ever see domestic creatures like domestic ducks or domestic turkeys that would take up with wild ones?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it happens quite often, as a matter of fact. As a wildlife rehabber, you've known probably of or seen stories of dogs or cats who took a wildling in. I know of a story of a dog who took a fawn under their wing, and very, very strong maternal instincts seem to take over, and it doesn't matter what critter. I had a dog who actually raised two feral kittens to adult cats. So it does happen. And,
we once had a domestic duck that, because growing up as a wildlife rehabilitator, sometimes people are confused about what's wild and what's not.
Right.
And so we ended up with a bunch of young mallards and a white domestic duck.
Sure.
And we just put them together, and this duck was convinced that it was just like all of its siblings, and it actually flew away with them in the fall.
Sure.
Of course, it probably didn't make it back, I would think, because they get so heavy that they stop having the ability to fly. But
it was
a remarkably good flyer for a domestic duck.
Yeah.
Randy from Urbandale sent us this question. He wants to know how homeless domesticated animals survive the winter, and if they prepare the same as wild animals. Do they have those same, can they pick up on the cues of day length, et cetera?
Well, most of the homeless domestic critters we're talking about are dogs and cats, and survival rates are lower certainly than they are of other domestic animals, but it's surprising the number that do make it through a winter. And it's their hearkening back, I think, to their wild genes that allow them to do so. They find food successfully. They find areas that are sufficient shelter to from storms and that to allow them to make it through. They're canny enough to avoid being taken by owls or coyotes or other predators in the area.
But their biological clocks have been messed with, haven't they? I mean, for example, they'll go into heat pretty much any time during the year, and that can cause a problem for the survival of offspring.
Well, one of the ways that we know, for example, that coyotes, there's in some areas of the country, there are what are called coy dogs, where domestic dogs and coyotes have interbred. And one of the ways we can identify those is that the females come into heat twice a year rather than once a year, which is the normal for coyotes. So, yeah, there certainly is some some alteration from domesticity back to the wild again. But they seem to respond pretty much. If they're survivors, if they survive, they've learned how to respond very similarly to wild populations.
Speaking of heat and mating.
Sure.
One of the things that we often see when
this is not the Valentine's show,
right? Though. I know. But one of the things that we do often see when the weather warms up early is that we start to see baby animals earlier than normal.
Right.
This weird winter where it's just never gotten cold, is there a danger that some of the animals are going to start thinking thoughts of love in January?
Well, it's interesting because that's a very good question and one that I thought our listeners would ask before you did, but they didn't. And it's a fascinating question because I did hear a male chickadee somewhat hesitant, but he did put out that male territorial call, the chickadee, which goes the other day when it was 60 plus degrees out. And he didn't do it incessantly like they do once the weather truly gets warmer and the days truly do get a lot longer. Their response primarily is, I haven't heard a cardinal sing yet. Their response, it's a mix of somewhat temperature related, but it's certainly very much controlled by day length. Those genes that say go with the day length and not the current weather are very, very strong indicators from many, many millennia of evolution that have told them you're going to survive best if you wait. At the same time, there's always one or two out there that's going to go, well, you know, it kind of feels like spring. Why not? But they're very strongly photoperiod or day length inspired. So temperatures can help, but they really supplement the response to day length.
All right. So when we're getting close to the correct day length and it warms up, then we can see the shift, but hopefully not this early.
We still have February and March to go yet. And if I listen to the state climatologist and his records show that warm Januarys mean pretty cold Februarys and March. So.
And sometimes April, too.
That's right.
Tanning is on the line in Iowa City at 866-780-9100. Hi, what's your question?
Good morning to you both. I live in a rural part of Iowa City, and part of my backyard and beyond is a wooded area frequented by coyotes. Mm-hmm. Last night, they were in my backyard. Mm-hmm. It seems like they all wanted to talk, each one louder, and then all of a sudden, they stop and quiet returns. It's like they have a conductor.
Yes.
I assume it's all related to a food source, but could you please explain this behavior?
It is talking. It's how coyotes communicate, and it's usually within family groups that they're communicating with one another. But if you listen carefully, if you're out far enough where you hear more than one family group, one pack, respond to one another, it's also somewhat territorial. It says, hey, we're better than you are over here, and we've got a larger territory, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But the talk that you're hearing, the howling, is very much a family group. And the responses are the interpretation of that is quite varied. Some say it's and it does seem to be a response in part to food supply, happiness over potential food. But it's also a greeting to one another, just as when you come into a family reunion, hey, how are you? I haven't seen you in a long time. That sort of thing. So it really has a combination of meanings and is quite fun to listen to, as you apparently did last night. Were they out with the moon, with a bright full moon last night?
Yes, I couldn't see them, of course, but they were really close to the house.
Sure, yeah, and a still night with the cold air like that, boy, it really carries though too. It carries a long way and can sound like they're closer than they really are. But it's quite fascinating to listen to.
Truly, I thank you kindly for your program, Dr. Peace and Charity.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next up, we've got Tom on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Charity. I've got kind of a screwball question. Every once in a while, you know, when you hear ducks calling up in the sky, you just kind of instinctively look up. And every once in a while, you see them flying in slightly the wrong direction, like to the northeast or northwest, not usually directly north.
Right.
But like at this time of year, why are they doing that? Is it just a temporary lapse of direction?
Well, they don't always fly south to get to where they're going. They have to fly in other directions, particularly going out to feed. They may go in any direction to go out to feed. The general, when they are in true migratory form, where they're often very high up, flapping very rapidly and flying in either a northerly or southerly direction, they may be following a river, for example. They follow rivers quite regularly. That determines the flight plan for the day. And the rivers don't flow straight north or south. They often flow east or west, or sometimes on a curve will flow a little bit north. But they follow those river valleys in general. And so they may be, if they're migrating, just following the river valleys and where they go. But they may also be going out. They may be holding out in an area for a while because of open water and going out to feed during the day. And that's probably what you've seen.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Tom. And we're almost out of time, Jim. But there's another bird that we've seen quite a behavior change from for this winter as opposed to, say, last winter or the cold winter before that, and that is the bald eagle. It has not been a great winter for eagle watching for a lot of people because in the winter they normally gather along the rivers.
Right. They gather along the rivers, and they're still doing that, but they don't – because so much water is open, they're not restricted in where they're gathering. Often in the wintertime when the lakes above dams freeze, they're restricted to that area below the dam. And this year with wide open water in very much of the state, lots of open water to choose from, they're much more dispersed. They're not concentrated in certain areas. So the eagle watching for a while may not be as thrilling, but they're certainly out there in numbers all across the state. And I've seen them flying in places in January that I've never expected to see them. So
yeah, I've noticed the same thing, and I've gotten to watch some riding some thermals in some areas where I didn't see them last year. But last year, along the Iowa River, I got to watch dozens of eagles, now this year we see one, maybe two.
Sure, yeah, and they're just spread out along the river, and so you can go to other areas and still see them. As you say, it's not quite as thrilling to seeing, you know, dozens in one place, but it's still quite a thrill to see them around.
And especially considering that they were so nearly gone
so
many years ago.
Yeah.
Before we go, is there anything you're worried about because of this unusual winter?
No, actually, the only worry that I've heard from people is that, geez, some of the pests that usually get wiped out by the winter are probably not going to get wiped out. And that refers, if you're a gardener or a farmer, to some of the hibernators. Sometimes a cold winter, particularly deep frost in the ground, will lower the population of ground squirrels and woodchucks in the spring because they simply freeze to death. They don't dig their tunnel deep enough. So I suspect unless we get a severe cold in February and no snow, in which the frost will go very deep in the ground, that we'll probably see better overwinter survival of all kinds of things, from pests to things that you want to see overwinter as well.
All right, Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Get out there in these beautiful days into the wild.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Jason Burns in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime. You can ask questions about things you'd heard on the show, make suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme is music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow at this time, Governor Terry Branstad will give his Condition of the State address. We'll listen to the speech and get analysis from Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.